moral compass. Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour Party a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. A video was leaked this week showing Downing Street staffers joking about a Christmas party held there last December, while the country was under COVID lockdown. The scandal has already led to the resignation of Johnson's spokeswoman, Allegra Stratton.
My remarks seemed to make light of the rules. Rules that people were doing everything to obey. That was never my intention. I will regret those remarks for the rest of my days, and I offer my profound apologies to all of you at home for them.
The British Prime Minister has denied that there was a party and apologised for the video.
I apologise for the impression that has been given that staff in Downing Street take this less than seriously. I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
While the leaked video was the talk of town, reports came out about 2 more lockdown gatherings at the Downing Street, including one at Johnson's own flat. A probe is now underway into whether the parties broke COVID rules. The Premier is facing calls to step down.
Downing Street willfully broke the rules and mocked the sacrifices we have all made, shattering the public's trust. The Prime Minister has a duty, the only right and moral choice left to him. It is for his resignation.
Yeah. Labour leader Keir Starmer is strongly critical of Johnson too.
But there's also this basic question of trust, and that is broken with the Prime Minister, okay. And that's why he is unfit for office.
In recent months, the British Prime Minister has faced criticism over other issues, including his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. That's beside revelations Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal in August. Now the latest scandal involving the lockdown parties may be the final nail in the coffin as Johnson's popularity continues to plummet. More than half of those taking part in the latest opinion poll believe that the Premier should step down.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist out of Bristol, and Fra Hughes, journalist and political analyst out of Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Let's start this off in Bristol. And Tony, your take on the overall reaction of the British public and dealing with this Christmas party scandal.
Well, look, Marcio, he's gone from hero to zero, hasn't he? The man who could get Brexit done, and now he's plummeting in the polls. But there's two important aspects to this that haven't really been covered, I don't think, anywhere near enough. One of them is, if Boris Johnson is to go, who is going to replace him? And I think we always got to look at the man standing in the shadows behind the curtain. And that would almost certainly be Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, who is very much a creature of the City of London. He's a former employee of some of the big financial institutions, and that would, of course, put them in the driving seat rather than the Conservative Party as a whole. So, you know, we need to look carefully at, you know, maybe what's going on here. If Boris is going to be moved out of the way, who is going to be taking his place? Very important, and people often forget that. It's very easy to throw mud at whoever's in power. And what we often forget is that actually maybe they are just put there in power by some more powerful forces behind the scenes. I think that's mostly the case in Western politics anyway. The other thing is that this seems to have all happened because Boris has instituted this thing called Plan B a fortnight or so ago. And there's been increasing calls from all sides for him to go because of this. Now, this is as a massive overreaction, in my view, to the Omicron variant. Now, you know, some have called this Omicron variant a gift from God, because what it does is it enables people to become immune after catching it, and it's very unlikely that anyone will die of it. It's a very mild version of the disease. So rather than embracing this, this has been jumped on as a terrible, terrible thing. And I think there's many people on all sides of the political spectrum, and particularly in the press, who feel that what Johnson's done by overreacting to this and following along with some of the alarmist speculation about the tens of thousands of deaths and hospitalizations that may result from something which the South Africans tell us is very mild is also related to this. So, I mean, I think it's clear that the press is leading this. And also, I think, whereabouts have these leaks come from, these leaks about the party? Let's look at the facts. So the party that Boris Johnson is alleged to have presided over, he wasn't at that party and he took no part in it. So it's quite feasible that it was arranged by somebody who was at Downing Street, like his chief of staff, etc., behind his back. And I think that's not impossible, although, of course, he may well have known about it. And certainly the police who guard 10 Downing Street would certainly have known about it. So it's very strange that they didn't act at the time. There are actually a lot of prosecutions going through in Britain still, right now, of ordinary people like you and I that were caught having apparently illegal parties at this time of year. Why not the top people? So the police have got a lot of questions to answer too on that occasion. So okay. I think, you know, what I'm trying to do, Marcia, is trying to get behind this, because I'm a bit, little bit concerned when I see the press all going at the same time. And I'm also always very, very aware of, if Boris is moved out of the way, who's going to take over and what influences do they represent?
Okay. All right. Well, let me get in on this conversation. I mean, many say that they, the public's upset because they feel that Johnson lied. At least, as Tony says, that's exactly what's being talked about in the press. But, I mean, it wasn't like he was known to be an honest person before he was elected as prime minister, from his extramarital affairs to so many other situations, whether we're talking about Brexit or other lies that he has been known to tell. So, I mean, what is it that all of a sudden, as Tony has said, I mean, there seems to be an unbelievable reaction when you didn't elect an honest person to begin with. I mean, why such an uproar? They're thinking that maybe he lied now. I mean, what is this really about, in your perspective?
Well, I would have to say it's possible that there's some form of a political coup going on in the background. If you remember that this actual accusation about the party in Downing Street was nearly 12 months ago, so obviously this evidence, this videotape, this recording has been in someone's hands for 12 months before it's been put out into the public domain. So it's possible there's a political coup in the background orchestrated by other members of the Conservative Party, indeed maybe front bench members of the Conservative Party, who want to oust Johnson in favour of a new leader. That said, it was only in 2019 that Boris Johnson was denying accusations that he burnt a £50 note in front of a homeless person when he was a student many years ago in London. I think we should bear in mind that there have been scandals all the way through his premiership. We had the Dominic Cummins affair, and then we had Neil Ferguson resign as senior analyst with the government. Boris Johnson has a track record of being a bit of a bluffer and a blagger, and he's someone who talked himself into power and talks himself out of trouble. I don't think Johnson will actually go anywhere. There's an 80-seat majority for the Conservative Party within the British Parliament. He's probably in a stronger position than any party political leader has been in decades. And I think it's very important for Boris Johnson that having such a large majority in the House, and there is no election planned before May 2024, I think he will just ride this out the same way he has done with every other political scandal in his career to date.
But Tony, Labour leader there is saying it's a problem, basic question of trust. And again, I mean, we look at this and it's almost comical, I guess, unfortunately, when we hear politicians talk about trust, but especially, again, Boris Johnson and his given record. It just seems, as you all you already mentioned, there seems to be political maneuvering out of this, that someone is trying to get to something else, of course, with the cover of this Christmas party. I mean, as you said, you're a journalist, so especially journalists know that when the mainstream media makes a big deal out of something, you better look behind it and see exactly what's going on. So you talked about some of the possibilities of the political maneuvering taking place here. Where do you see this going exactly? Do you think, opposite from our guests in Belfast, that it could actually cause the fall of Johnson or not?
Well, yes. I mean, I think I do, because, first of all, I'll say it was just over a year ago, all these so-called parties, etc., and now the things we've seen as evidence parties, happened about a year ago. But it was just before that, the resignation of Dominic Cummings behind the scenes. Now, he was the chief of staff at Downing Street, and he's a very Machiavellian character. He brags about reading Sun Tzu's Art of War and The Prince by Machiavelli. These kind of it doesn't seem as if he was in there to do a good job for the public. He was there to do political manoeuvring. It may well be him that's spearheaded the release of these various leaks at this particular time. And this is one of the things that happens, I think, I'm afraid, in journalism too, is that journalists and editors will hang on to stuff for a long time in order to use it to threaten and eventually maybe use it to manoeuvre out a specific individual, in this case, Boris Johnson. Now, there's another aspect to this, and that is there's something in the Conservative Party called the 1922 Committee, and this is a big, powerful committee of backbenchers, people who are not involved in the government. In other words, they're not on Boris's payroll, but what they can do is they can order a vote of the membership of the parliamentary party and of the whole Conservative Party of confidence in Boris. So even though Boris has got a big majority in the Houses of Parliament, it may be his own party can unseat him and replace him, even though he's in that position. So that is entirely possible. But I think it's also fascinating and very important, you mentioned yourself, the killing of civilians in Yemen and places like this, because of course all this gets drowned out in the distraction of what's going on at Westminster, which is effectively its internal Conservative Party manoeuvrings, I think, that's going on. And it's not helped by the fact that the Labour Party is on Tuesday this coming week, the Labour Party is due to vote with Boris, supporting Boris in the stricter COVID measures he's trying to bring in, whereas many of his own party are revolting against him. Well, what this means is that the Labour Party, the opposition party in Britain, could potentially bring down the government voting against it and embarrass it, but it's choosing to vote with Boris instead. So there's a 40, 50, 60 backbenchers about to vote against Boris Johnson, and Labour could have voted with them and made it very, very difficult for Boris to continue and to have any credibility. They have chosen. So what I'm saying is the real opposition politically in the Houses of Parliament, in the House of Commons today, is the Conservative Party. And that is an extraordinary position to be in the country. So distraction away from these wars abroad, I think you're absolutely right to point that out. This is still carrying on with British military facilities being moved over to Saudi Arabia to aid this bombing of Yemen, etc., which is continuing to this day. I think that these are the sorts of issues that get drowned out. What I'd like to see is I'd like to see some real, genuine leadership in the country, and also some genuine attitudes from the press in right across the Western world in calling out some of this horrifically amoral, immoral, attempts to manoeuvre, particularly in the Middle East. And of course, we've had the appalling news about the injustices to Julian Assange, which Boris Johnson himself doesn't seem to have mentioned once, even though it's one of the most important court cases ever to take place on the planet, which is taking place right now in London. Boris has nothing to say about that, and that's another reason why he's losing support fast.
Okay, well, turning back to Belfast, I mean, your perspective, Tony just mentioned, for example, Assange, and I want to look at that situation that we don't see that type of outrage one would think would see coming out of the British public. And again, I go back to London's support for repressive regimes, whether we're talking about Israel or Saudi Arabia, or we're talking about Bahrain, that they're giving these weapons to these repressive regimes and supporting them in so many different ways. And yet nothing is said. Is it because the British public, the public is not informed? Is it that they don't care? Or is it the role of the media? How do you assess this overall?
Well, I think what you've asked is a very, very, very interesting question. If we stick with Julian for just 1 second, his exposure of the Afghan war logs was what brought him to the attention and WikiLeaks of the world public. He exposed war crimes carried out by America, done in the name of the American people, part of the propaganda war that's preceded nearly everything that's happened with these humanitarian interventions throughout the world on behalf of Britain, NATO, America, mainly at the behest and in favour of strengthening Israel's position within the region by attacking strong anti-Zionist governments that stand with and beside the Palestinian people. So Julian is suffering from the revenge of the American administration for him showing the world what America is doing in the name of democracy and these humanitarian interventions. I think that Britain is completely complicit in the war crimes that are carried out within West Asia and the Middle East. I don't think that some people who claim Britain are the lapdogs of America and have somehow, you know, bowed down to American demands to have Julian Assange extradited. I think Keir Starmer, who was involved in the original prosecution, I believe Boris Johnson and the whole British establishment are more than happy to see Julian Assange face 175 years in the darkest, deepest hole that they can find in the American penal system. So Britain is complicit and has always been complicit in its own colonial history and in its present bombing of Yemen, probably secret attacks in Syria, the destruction of Libya. They are all birds of a feather, these neoliberal, colonial, quasi-imperialist, capitalist governments that are there to demonize and to extract resources from the southern hemisphere to come to the northern hemisphere. And I believe that the reason, it's quite possible that a lot of this is just pure distraction from the debacle of Brexit, from Julian's extradition, from everything that else is happening. It could be smoke and mirrors. Look over here as a distraction while we continue to bomb, maim, and terrorize people throughout the globe.
Well, Tony, it just seems that there is a lack of any type of moral compass in British politics. It just seems that it's money, it's economics over morality. I mean, your perspective on that and the effect of that type of mentality and those who are ruling the country, the effect that it has overall.
Well, look, I want to reassure you, Marcia, it's actually not all over British politics. There is actually a very important faction in both of the main political parties which does have a moral compass. It's just that the way the system works is that the Prime Minister will recruit yes-men And I would say, actually, what he's dealing with is a dwindling supply of them into the cabinet. I mean, for example, we've got, you know, a Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who was involved in all these secret meetings with the Israeli government, and yet she was invited back in, even though she broke the ministerial code when she was International Development Secretary. She was presiding over a massive assault against a vigil in the city, in the centre of London on Clapham Common, and yet she suffered no penalty because of that. I think Boris Johnson is paying the price of sticking with this small coterie of amoral Conservative MPs who he's managed to recruit into the cabinet. But there is, as I said, quite a force out there within the backbenchers in the Parliamentary Conservative Party who are getting increasing. They're looking at the numbers. The numbers of MPs who are pro-Boris and anti-Boris, and also the numbers of members of the Conservative Party, and they're realising they're getting to the point where maybe they can just unseat Boris and replace him with somebody else. And quite who that, I mean, that, like I said, it may be Rishi Sunak. But I think we also need to look, when we're looking at the perspective of all these sometimes incomprehensible wars that are going on in the Middle East, the British and the Americans particularly have been supporting, that there is a long-term plan, during the Second World War, to institute the State of Israel, and secondly, to create a war in order to discredit all the three main monotheistic faiths. And this, I think, has been ongoing for a long time, and many people haven't actually seen that this is an attempt to actually, I mean, people say, like my own family, I talk to them and they say, well, no one wants a war. Well, actually, some people do. For these sort of spiritual and ideological reasons, they want to have a war to discredit these faiths, and they also want to have that war to make a lot of money. And so the only forces we've got are within the House of Commons, the people who are not in the key positions in Keir Starmer or Boris Johnson's cabinets, you know, the shadow cabinet Starmer's got. Those are the people, I think, that may make a difference here.
Okay.
And it's very important that we keep a very close eye on what these backbenchers are up to, because they will decide Boris's fate.
All right. And for 1 minute, where do you see all of this going in and affecting British politics? Your assessment overall?
Well, I think there was a very interesting poll that came out recently, a YouGov poll on how politicians act in power and why they are there. 5% of the respondents said that politicians were there to work on behalf of the public, and 63% of the respondents said the politicians were there to promote themselves. So what we have are millionaires and billionaires in an elite clique within the political structures that govern the country, and people like ourselves see them for what they are. They are people who are self-promoters and are using politics in order to line their own pockets.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on the Spotlight. Out of Bristol, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, and out of Belfast, Frau Hughes, journalist and political analyst. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. Make sure you join us right here next time. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam dini wa al-ard ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La 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 la
are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij in his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Let's talk about the prayer rules or the Islamic laws related to prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. What are the obligatory prayers that one should in fact offer or say in one's lifetime?
The religious authorities, including Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have enumerated the obligatory prayers which one must offer in his lifetime, of course. To begin with, I would like to say that the first obligatory prayer is the daily obligatory prayer, the five daily prayers, which every duty-bound person or mukallaf has to offer. Of course, we have discussed in our previous programs who a duty-bound person is, so that's not what we should discuss at this time.
Sheikh Zawid, when we say daily, some people may argue that they don't belong to the night, because we all also offer the prayers, in fact, during Maghrib time, you know, which is dark, basically, or dusk.
Yes, of course.
So daily doesn't mean only including those
daytime
prayers offered in the daytime, yes.
You're right. What
we mean is regular prayers.
Yeah,
basically.
The regular prayers, the obligatory prayers which are offered during 24 hours. Okay. So the five daily prayers, as we term it, of course, as usually the Muslims all over the world better understand this collocation.
Yes, sure.
Now, the second obligatory prayer is the tawaf prayer, or the prayer which is offered immediately after the circumambulation rite.
Mm-hmm.
The tawaf which is offered, that which is performed during Hajj pilgrimage. Of course, immediately after the Hajj pilgrimage, there is a prayer which is called Salat al-Tawaf, or the prayer tawaf prayer, which has to be offered immediately after completion of the tawaf or circumambulation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have namaz ayat, or the ayat prayer, or salat al-ayat, because different people term this prayer differently.
Mm-hmm.
Arabs call it salat al-ayat, the English people might call it ayat prayers or sign prayers, and then the Persians or Indians or Pakistanis might call it namaz ayat. So it doesn't differ, but it becomes obligatory on the occurrence of, for example, a disaster, a natural disaster like
an earthquake,
or maybe a very frightening thunder, or lightning,
or flood,
or anything which causes fear among in the hearts of people.
Yes.
Now this is number three. And then we have Salat al-Mayyit, okay?
Yes.
Salat for which is performed on a dead body. They call it funeral prayer.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Funeral
is
prayer.
Is it obligatory?
Yeah, it is obligatory, definitely. And it's a kind of it's prayer, but it's a kind of prayer for the deceased person, because you don't have to make wudu, you don't have to take off your shoes. And you just, there's no rakat, there's no ruku, there's no sujood, of course, but there are five takbirs which must be offered. So this is, technically it's called, namaz al-mayyid or salat al-mayyid.
Is it obligatory for only those people who attend the funeral?
No, it's not obligatory. It's a collective obligation, in fact.
Uh-huh.
A collective obligation means that if one person, out of many people, offers the prayer, other people are relieved of the obligation.
I see.
But it can be offered in congregation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the prayer, there will be a prayer leader, other people will stand on behind him, and they will make niyyah of Salat al-Mayyit, they will offer it, and then everybody will earn the reward, will get the sawab of offering Salat al-Mayyit.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back.
Sure.
Continuing the obligatory prayers from Shaykh Javi.
La ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hosnain, and Sheikh Javid, still in the studio talking about the obligatory prayers. Are there any obligatory prayers left?
Of course. We have the qada prayers, or the prayers missed by our parents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? By our parents, by our father and maybe our mother, according to Supreme Leader. Different religious authorities have said different things when it comes to qada prayers of mother.
Mm-hmm.
Of mother. But when it comes to the qada prayers of your father, of course, the religious scholars are agreed on this fact, that the eldest son has to give the qada of the prayers of his father.
The earliest son, not the daughter.
Yeah, the eldest son, not the eldest child.
Or child, yes.
But when it comes to the prayers missed by one's mother, of course, a supreme leader also says that it is obligatory for the eldest son to give the qada prayers of his mother as well.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to our own qada prayers, of course, they're also wajib, but they are included in the daily prayers.
Yes.
Because we are supposed to offer those prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And if we happen to miss those prayers, we have to, offer the qada. And then we have the prayer which becomes obligatory as a result of a pledge we make, or a result of a vow which we make, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe as a result of qasam. For example, if I make a vow and say that, okay, if such and such hajat is fulfilled, then I'm going to offer, let's say, 40 rakas of prayer, or maybe I will offer prayers for 1 month.
Yes.
Or maybe I will offer 2 rakas of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So it will become obligatory. Right. On the fulfillment of our wish, it will become obligatory to offer that prayer. That's called namaz ahd or nazar or qasam, you know, because of this.
Because of the promise.
Or maybe made. Because of someone giving you some money and you agreed to offer prayers on his father's behalf or on his mother's behalf, because you have agreed in the first place to offer the qada of his parents' prayer, okay?
Yes, of course, for the deceased person.
For the deceased person, not the person who is alive.
Yes.
So you are actually a hired person.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who is hired, it becomes obligatory on him to offer the qada of the money of the prayer for the money which he has received.
Yes.
Okay. This is. These are some obligatory prayers, of course. Prayers become obligatory when we make, for example, a vow, or when we make a qasam, or make a promise that we will offer. It becomes, provided that we should recite the formula. A special formula is recited. For example, Lillahi alayya. We usually say, in according to the formula, if we said Lillahi alayya nusalli rak'atayn min as-salat, it is from Allah upon me to recite two rakas of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
If a certain haja or a certain wish is granted, then that prayer actually becomes obligatory.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, these are some of the obligatory prayers which I mentioned.
Very quickly, Sheikh, because we don't have much time, you know, what about the Eid al-Adha prayer, or when they sacrifice the sheep, you know, on that occasion, and also the Fitr prayer?
Mm-hmm. There are some.
They are not obligatory.
Yeah, they are not obligatory in the present time,
mm-hmm.
which is the time of, let's say, the time of the major occultation.
Yes.
Occultation of the Imam. Of course, we have Namaz Wahshad also.
Yes.
And there are, you know, Mustahab. It's recommended to offer the Wahshad prayer, but it's not obligatory to recite that prayer. And of course, we have many, many Nawafil prayers, many Mustahab prayers, which, inshallah, we will discuss in the following episodes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Sami'un Basir لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Mohammed once again tops the list for the most popular boy's name for newborns in the UK. According to parenting website Baby Centre, the name of Islam's holy prophet was the most popular name for boys in 2021, meaning the beloved Muslim name has held the top spot for the fifth year in a row.
Sadly, British Muslims are living in an era of growing Islamophobia, and simply having a Muslim-sounding name could inspire discrimination. However, despite this, the name remains as popular as ever, and it's growing year upon year.
So why do so many Muslim parents want to name their sons Mohammed? I asked a community leader to find out more.
When we pronounce the name of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it is a full of barakah. And if you see the meaning of Muhammad literally, it means the you can say praise again praise. The person who is praised and whose praise is not coming to an end. So Muslims love their Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Hence they keep the name of their children Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And also there is many reward. If a person has the name Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the day of, you can say, judgment, God will say, you will enter paradise. He is not only for the Muslim. He is the mercy for the mankind. He is the, you can say, light for each and everyone. So this is our duty. Now, I would like to request to our, you can say, people, those they are not aware about it, they must study.
Baby Center said the name also tops the website's most popular boy's name for the entire decade, while other high-ranking baby names for boys and girls in 2021 with Muslim connections include Fatima, Ali, and Layla, further cementing the theory that Islam could become the most successful religion in the Western world in the not-too-distant future. Robert Carter, London.
Israeli media revealed the new settlement projects being advanced by Israel's Justice Ministry in East Al-Quds that would eventually push Palestinians out of their homes in several areas of the Holy City. According to the reports, the ministry's so-called custodian of absentee property is promoting new settlements and settler housing units in Sheikh Jarrah, Damascus Gate, near Beit Safafa, in Sur Baher, and in Beit Hanina. The custodian of absentee property takes possession of Palestinian properties whose owners Israel considers to reside outside the Palestinian territories, regardless of the fact that Palestinian families live in these homes since 1948 as tenants because they are not the original owners.
Israel continues to seize Palestinian properties under the so-called absentee law. It demolishes Palestinians' homes and properties. All this comes under the policy of ethnic cleansing and forcing Palestinians out of the holy city. It's part of their larger plan to achieve the dream of greater Al-Quds. But our people insist on their struggle and remain adherent to their inalienable rights.
Anti-settlement groups say if Israel succeeds in implementing the move, this will definitely entail the eviction of Palestinian residents, repeating the same scenario of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The groups accuse the Israeli regime of insisting on pushing Palestinians out of the Holy City, regardless of the consequences. They also inquire why the Israeli regime refuses to return these homes to their real owners instead of bringing in new settlers and expanding settlements.
If this is an absentee law, return back these people to their original houses, which is still there, still in the old city, still occupied by other Israeli settlers, Jews. So there is no justice in this, and this is like clearly this is in a kind of an occupation laws that they are targeting the indigenous and the people of the city.
Today, there are about 500,000 Israeli settlers living in the occupied West Bank, with almost 250,000 more living in Al-Quds settlements, which are considered in violation of international law.
Palestinians angrily wonder how the Israeli laws allow the Jewish settlers to take over their properties under numerous claims. But at the same time, this right is denied to the real owners, the Palestinians, who have been forced out of their assets in 1948, ever since Israel's establishment. Muna Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
EU Foreign Affairs Ministers gathered in Brussels on Monday for their final scheduled meeting of 2021. They accuse Moscow of massing troops near Ukraine's border in preparation for a possible invasion.
The ministers, all of them, have been very clear today that any aggression against Ukraine will come with political consequences and with a high economic cost for Russia.
Moscow denies it intends to invade Ukraine and accuses Kiev of Western-backed provocation. Many analysts say the EU's undying support for Ukraine is nothing short of scandalous. Just last September, the European Court of Auditors, the 27-nation bloc's financial watchdog, published a report showing that corruption in Ukraine is rife at the highest levels amongst politicians, the judiciary and state-owned enterprises. The report states that since 2014, EU taxpayers have sent 12.5 billion euro to Kiev via the European Commission, but corruption reform efforts have failed. New sanctions against Russia being considered by the EU include travel bans and asset freezes targeting politicians. The Federation's banking sector could be hit. Perhaps the new gas pipeline between Russia and Germany might be blocked from becoming operational. The Kremlin has warned against further provocation. Despite all the rhetoric, analysts point out that the EU and Russia are major trading partners, particularly in the area of energy.
I think that the very existence of this strong economic interconnectivity is encouraging to look for the ways for the better political relations.
Those relations are currently at an all-time low and will be the subject of much debate when EU leaders hold a summit here in the Belgian capital this Thursday. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Prisoners' advocacy groups and prisoners' rights activists have held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons and detention centers. The sit-in, which took place inside the Red Cross office in Gaza, comes only one day after the Israeli regime renewed the administrative detention order of Hisham Abu Hawash, who has been on hunger strike protesting his administrative detention for nearly 4 months. Some 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held in Israeli jails under administrative detention. Administrative detainees are incarcerated based on secret evidence without charge or trial for long periods of time.
Administrative detention has been an Israeli policy for decades in order to break the will of Palestinian prisoners. Israel, as an occupying power, used administrative detention to illegally hold thousands of Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. The apathy of the international community has encouraged the Israeli regime to violate the rights of Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners are kept in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities. They include women and children as well as elderly prisoners.
Currently, there are 39 female prisoners in Israeli jails, including 10 mothers. They also include sick and wounded female prisoners. The detention conditions inside Israeli jails are extremely bad, especially for women and children. Israeli prison guards target female prisoners and humiliate them all the time.
According to legal experts, Tel Aviv has long considered itself above international law and conventions due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States. Currently, around 4,500 Palestinian prisoners are being held in Israeli custody under inhumane conditions.
At least 4,500 prisoners are held inside Israeli jails under horrible detention conditions. We demand that Israel be held accountable for its violations against Palestinian prisoners. Israel must treat Palestinian prisoners in accordance with the Fourth Geneva Convention and other international treaties regarding prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians. According to the latest statistics, Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967.
Thousands of Palestinians are currently behind bars and languishing in Israeli prisons. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour Party a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. A video was leaked this week showing Downing Street staffers joking about a Christmas party held there last December while the country was under COVID lockdown. The scandal has already led to the resignation of Johnson's spokeswoman, Allegra Stratton.
My remarks seemed to make light of the rules. Rules that people were doing everything to obey. That was never my intention. I will regret those remarks for the rest of my days, and I offer my profound apologies to all of you at home for them.
The British Prime Minister has denied that there was a party and apologised for the video.
I apologise for the impression that has been given that staff in Downing Street take this less than seriously. I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
While the leaked video was the talk of town, reports came out about two more lockdown gatherings at the Downing Street, including one at Johnson's own flat. A probe is now underway into whether the parties broke COVID rules. The Premier is facing calls to step down.
Downing Street willfully broke the rules and mocked the sacrifices we have all made, shattering the public's trust. The Prime Minister has a duty, the only right and moral choice left to him. It is for his resignation.
Yeah. Labour leader Keir Starmer is strongly critical of Johnson too.
But there's also this basic question of trust, and that is broken with the Prime Minister. Okay. And that's why he is unfit for office.
In recent months, the British Prime Minister has faced criticism over other issues, including his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. That's beside revelations Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal in August. Now the latest scandal involving the lockdown parties may be the final nail in the coffin as Johnson's popularity continues to plummet. More than half of those taking part in the latest opinion poll believe that the Premier should step down.
Iran's lead negotiator at the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, says his team has not yet received any proposal or initiative from the other side to help resolve the outstanding issues.
Both on the issue of sanctions removal and nuclear measures, there have been disagreements. These are clearly visible in the draft that was achieved following the previous round of talks. The disagreements, especially on the nuclear issue, are numerous and varied. On these disagreements, we have not yet received any proposal or initiative from the other side.
In the past days, questions have arisen about the drafts being discussed and whether the Iranian team's amendments and proposals, offered in the form of two written drafts at the beginning of the seventh round, are still on the table.
Over the past few days, we have had various meetings at the levels of experts and senior political directors, during which the modifications, viewpoints and proposals of the Iranian side on the June 20th draft were discussed, and these discussions were positive and moving forward.
Iran says it would only go back to full compliance after the full and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. And while some sources say the Iranian demands are stalling progress, others, like Russia's lead delegate, maintain the atmosphere is positive amid intensive dialogue.
The important thing for Iran is that the current negotiations move forward and that all of the sanctions, the maximum pressure sanctions, are removed, and there's a verification process. And Iran really has to be compensated for all the damage that Western countries have done to the people of Iran.
On Sunday, a third working group focusing on the sequencing of compliance by all parties was held for the first time during the seventh round of talks. That was followed by a trilateral meeting between Iran, Russia and China. There's been no official word yet about the duration of the current round of talks. Horma Lesky, Vienna.
The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are going beyond the casualties of airstrikes and an ongoing blockade. The Yemeni Pediatric Society says the number of infants with birth defects has increased rapidly since the 2015 war that turned Yemen into a testing ground for internationally banned weapons.
The weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition against our country contain prohibited chemicals that directly affect pregnant women and fetuses. That has increased the birth rate of children with cancer and congenital anomalies, especially in the areas that are being continuously bombed, such as Sana'a, Hodeidah, Hajjah, and Sada.
Officials say chemical and biological bombs dropped from Saudi warplanes on Yemenis have made Yemen the world's worst epidemic disaster. They're calling for an investigation into recent cases of congenital anomalies.
Since the first day of the aggression, the Saudi-led coalition has used various types of prohibited weapons, including cluster and phosphorus bombs, to target residential and agricultural areas. As a result of environmental contamination, we witnessed a dramatic rise of congenital malformations amongst children. We demand the documentation of the pathological cases caused by these bombs to reveal Saudi Arabia's war crimes.
Infants are suffering a difficult condition in Yemen in the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemeni health centers have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war.
As the war goes on, Yemeni children continue to be at the brunt of the death and destruction left behind by Saudi-banned weapons. People here believe that Riyadh has always been violating international law by using cluster munitions in bombing residential areas since it started its deadly war on Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. is stunned by a devastating storm of tornadoes that ripped through the six states of Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, as well as Tennessee overnight. Strong thunderstorms triggered dozens of tornadoes that crumbled metal like paper, swatted down concrete buildings, and threw a freight train off its track. Among notable casualties are a candle-making factory in Kentucky, a nursing home in Arkansas, and an Amazon warehouse in Illinois. An Illinois resident explains how he was shocked by the extent of damage after he rushed to his mother's house.
The damage is worse than some of the stuff I've seen in war pictures, so it's pretty intense. You know, it's not anything that I thought when she called me and told me that, oh, all my trees are gone. I was like, I got here and I did not expect to see this.
The town of Mayfield in Kentucky was described as ground zero by officials and appeared post-apocalyptic. A restaurant owner says the town's residents have lost it all.
It was just, this is our hometown, and it's just devastating. Everybody's lost everything.
Rescue workers across the middle of the country are combing through wreckage for survivors. Scores of deaths have already been confirmed, and officials warn that the toll is almost certain to rise as they are sifting through the ruins for the missing. President Joe Biden is going to travel to areas